Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 44, and today I have joined Nicholas Parra, Norman Mora, and Sergio Ariza in their home city of Bogota, Colombia, to discuss the seminar we held today on Plato's Apology. Sergio is assistant professor of philosophy at the Universidad de los Andes here in Bogota, Colombia, whose work focuses on ancient Greek philosophy, and he's currently working on a translation of the Meno with a commentary, and he has recently published an essay entitled Gorgias and the Incommunicability of Being, which is a critique of Morlatos's interpretation of Gorgias. Norman Mora is an undergraduate student working on his degree here at the Universidad de los Andes in literature and philosophy. And Nicholas Parra has been on the Digital Dialogue before when he was studying at Penn State. That was episode 21. And we discussed the relationship in that episode between philosophy and rhetoric in the Gorgias. And Nicholas is working on his MA in philosophy and also working on a degree in law. So his work focuses on aporia in Socrates. So Nicholas, Norman, and Sergio join me and today on the Digital Dialogue to discuss a paper I wrote on the Apology and the wonderful seminar that we had this morning on that text. So it's a great pleasure to welcome all three of you to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could start a little bit, Nicholas, with talking a little bit about my visit here and the paper and the seminar that we had this morning.
Yeah, well, the idea to invite you here to Bogota was to continue a dialogue that you and I held almost 2 years ago.
Yeah.
As you pointed out, we try to flesh out the relationship between philosophy and rhetoric, and now there's a kind of displacement in our work towards the political life, which,
yeah,
of course, echoes a little continuity with what we worked 2 years ago.
That's right.
So, and that's why we wanted to invite you here to discuss the relationship of philosophy and political life and how you see that relationship played out in the Apology.
Mm-hmm.
I guess with no further...
Well, let me just say also that it's been... I want to thank all of you here for making such a wonderful visit. Bogota is a beautiful city, and we've had sun and rain and everything. it's been interesting. And the other thing I guess I should say that Sergio and I may be speaking to each other in German on the podcast too, and we'll try to translate a little bit about what we're saying for an audience that might not understand all of that. So this will be a multilingual episode of the Digital Dialogue. So maybe we could start out a little bit talking about the paper, because I was, first of all, very grateful for all the preparation that went into having the students ready to talk about the Apology. It was really remarkable. The students were great and had great questions, for me, and clearly had done a lot of work around the Apology and thinking about the philosophical issues that are at stake there. So maybe Nicholas, do you want to say a few things about some of the issues that were brought up in the discussion and coming out of the paper?
Yeah, sure. Well, the discussion was on two different levels, I think. The first one was engaged in a question of what the dialogue, what was the meaning of the dialogue,
mm-hmm,
in certain passages, and how we interpret certain metaphors that Socrates uses or certain responses of the crowd,
right,
to Socrates' sayings. That was one of the,
mm-hmm,
discussion themes. But the other one was more related to your paper and the way you try to establish a hermeneutical principle to read the dialogues in a whole different way. Namely, you know, the distinction that you make between the topography of Platonic politics and the topology of Socratic politics.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that we could start maybe with that distinction, which is very powerful to give life to this text and to, in a way, extend their effect, their political effect, not only to Greek Athens, but to contemporary society. Yeah. Maybe.
So, okay, let me talk a little bit about the difference, and then that might lead us into the question that, Sergei, that you were asking at the beginning about how to read Wie man Plait lesen soll. And so the distinction between the topology of Socratic politics and the topography of Platonic politics is a distinction that I've been thinking about for a while, and it is one that attempts to delineate between what Socrates says in the dialogues and how he performs political activities in the dialogues dramatically with the people that he's talking with. So that's the topology, and I use the topos and logos there, the site of the saying of Socratic politics, to emphasize this dramatic dimension and to think about more about how politics is performed in the dialogues. And then on a second level is the question of what Plato is doing by writing in the way that he writes. And my argument is that he himself, in writing the way he does, is practicing a kind of politics that is similar to the kind of politics that Socrates is practicing in the dialogues. And so when we ask about Socratic writing, then we are asking really about the way in which the text is crafted and put together in ways that invite us to think about things that are important. And actually, Norman, you had a great question at the end of the seminar about the relationship between writing and saying. And maybe we could go back to that. Do you want to...
Before that,
can I
ask you something
yeah.
from what you said? You used the term dramatic, referring to Socrates. But don't you think that dramatic is not a feature in the writing of Plato?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the... I don't know how to say it. That
dramatization?
Yeah, it's something made by Plato, not something performed by Socrates.
Yeah, so I guess you're right. I think that's a good point, that when I talk about the taking seriously the dramatic elements of the dialogue, I am saying probably something both about the figure of Socrates in the dialogues and about the way Plato has put the characters together, right? And I think part of the problem with the distinction between topology and topography is that we can make a distinction, but you can't really hold them apart. And actually, that's what you were pressing me on, I thought, at the end, Norman, was that we need to think about writing and saying together. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that, my question this morning was about, like, precisely that, like, we used to think like Plato is the father of the whole tradition that tops voices over writing.
Mm-hmm.
But what one can get from your article is quite the opposite. Like, for Plato, it's not that writing is more important than speaking,
right.
but like both are a unity, and like one turn like goes to the other one, and it's just like a circle.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like
a thing of levels, but it's just
it goes back.
A kind of continuity and back and forth. Almost, I don't know if we want
almost to... Almost as if the condition of possibility of...
Of the other.
Of writing is also the condition... I mean, the condition of possibility of writing is, of course, the logos, the speaking part of Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it is the opposite, too.
Yeah.
The condition of possibility of speaking is the writing of Plato, and that's why he extended the effects of that practice of philosophy and politics to us.
Yeah, so that was a part of the larger point that I was trying to argue in the essay, was that the activity of reading these texts together, of coming to Bogota and presenting a paper and having a seminar on these ideas, is also a continuation of a kind of political practice in the spirit of both Plato and Socrates. So that if politics for both Socrates and Plato involves the attempt to turn people toward the good and the just, or at least to begin to ask that question, what is good and what is just, then as we do that with our students, as we do that with one another in reading these texts, we are continuing that tradition of political practice that comes from Socrates and through Platonic writing to us, and otherwise would have been lost without the writing.
Right.
So vielleicht haben wir ein bisschen über deine Frage über wie man Platon lesen soll. That Sergio asked a question at the beginning about how one should read Plato. So vielleicht kannst du etwas sagen.
Ja, okay. Also es ist klar, dass das ist die erste Frage bei Platon. Ne? Uh-huh. Also es ist eine Frage, die man nicht bei anderen Philosophen machen muss. Also es ist klar, man muss Kant lesen oder Hegel lesen. Uh-huh. Aber bei Platon gibt es immer dieses Problem. Also die Frage hat angefangen, eigentlich konkret auf die Apologie. Ne? Wie muss man die Apologie lesen? Besonders weil es ein besonderes Werk bei Platon. Ne? Es ist kein Dialog.
So, moment, now, let me translate a little bit of that and then we'll go on. So, Sega is saying is, with Plato, we have to ask the question, how do you read these texts? Unlike with Kant or other kinds of texts where you sort of just accept that they were written in a certain way, and are meant to be read in a certain way, that with Plato we always have to ask how do we read them. But that, so that's in general, but then more specifically, because the Apology is such a peculiar text in the Platonic corpus, we have to ask how do we read this dialogue. So yeah, go ahead. Do willst du etwas darüber sagen? Hast du etwas
Okay, habe ich was zu sagen? Als erstes ist das, also die Idee, dass du in Bogotá bist. Es ist eben, dass wir haben uns in den letzten Semestern, in den letzten Jahren interessiert für diese heterodoxe Leseart von Platon. Uh-huh. Ja? Also es ist klar, dass unser Interesse in diesen Dialogen kann sie nicht einschränken auf die Argumente. Mhm. Und die Frage ist, was machen wir mit dem Rest von den von den Tests? Ja? Und deshalb haben wir dieses Interesse, diese Meinungen, diese neue Tendenzen, oder die sind nicht so neu, ne? Ja. Aber irgendwie sind lebendig in den letzten Jahrzehnten geworden. Mhm. Und deshalb wollten wir diesen Dialog mit dir haben. Ja. In Bezug darauf, ich glaube, die Frage mit der Apologie ist ein Dialog oder ist es nicht ein Dialog?
It's okay, good. So, Sergio was saying that more recently here in Bogota, that you've been investigating what you're calling the heterodox reading of Plato. I'll embrace that. Okay, that's fair enough. That means I could be against the orthodox. That's good. The readings that attend to the dramatic context, attend to all the things that are not just about argument. When the traditional view, and maybe this is too much of a caricature, but the orthodox view might be that, well, philosophy is about concepts, about arguments, it's about rational thinking, and what we need to do with these texts is find those rational arguments and analyze them as to whether they're good or invalid, and then we'll sort of discover something important. And I think increasingly, certainly in the United States, and the work of a lot of the people in the Ancient Philosophy Society, which I'm involved with, but also for some time now, years now, there have been people really thinking more about how to read these dialogues in terms of the richness of their dramatic content. And to read them, in my view, as dialogues, as artistic creations that have characters and context. And then to think about the philosophical significance of what all of that means. So now then, but then the bigger issue, the one that we need to come to that Sergio has introduced, is the apology. Is it a dialogue or is it not a dialogue? So in my paper, I argue strongly that it is a dialogue, and that and then I focus on those moments in the apology where the men of Athens and the assembly create a disturbance in response to some of things that Socrates says. So I'm thinking in a way that that's the dialogical dimension of this text, that they're disturbing Socrates and having this these outbursts, thorubein is the Greek word for that, and it means really not just a disturbance but a disruptive one that is somewhat upset and angry. And so I wanted to point to those moments because I think those are the places where Socrates says things that move the audience to respond. And so I want to argue that there is a dialogue, and there's a continuity between this the apology and on the other Socratic dialogues that we read, that Socrates is who he is, the same person he is in the Apologia that he is in these other dialogues, first, and second, that even though he's addressing himself to a multitude, he still uses many of the same strategies that he does with individuals. Now, Nicholas took issue with that at the beginning of the seminar, so maybe you could talk a little bit. You're going to defend the "it's not a dialogue" argument.
Well,
didn't I convince you this way?
No, not really. But I don't want to dismiss your reading. I mean, it's very interesting to pose that kind of continuity between the other dialogues and the apology, and you will probably gain a lot of meanings or new meanings in the apology if you read it as a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think that's a strong way of reading the apology. But at the same time, I have my hesitations towards that reading because, for example, I really think that there's a radical difference between addressing a crowd and addressing an individual.
Mm.
And as I said early this morning, one of my arguments to say this is that Socrates is always trying to, in a way, he's a protean speaker.
Mm-hmm.
He's attentive and responsive to the individual who he's engaged with in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to always capture the needs and the way the other speaks.
Mm-hmm.
So that he also, in a way, transforms his way of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
In order to persuade. And then it comes the persuasion part of his political practice.
Right.
At the core of this argument, because when you don't have a definition of justice or truth, then it becomes necessary to persuade, and rhetoric becomes a good means,
mm-hmm,
to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my
Could we stop there just for a minute and,
sure,
talk a little bit more about that? Because do you think that let's talk about how Socrates is protean. So so in the apology, he says I'm going to be like a stranger here. I'm going to continue to talk the way I talk in the marketplace and everything else.
Right.
And he refuses to take on the language of the law court. He refuses, mm-hmm, to do what the standard practice is, which I guess would involve gratifying and praising and singing the praises of the city and the,
mm-hmm,
jurors there and all of that. So he doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But are there ways in which he does take on some of the language of the assembly or of the traditional politics?
No, definitely not. I mean, I think that the apology is dialogue, if you could call it that way.
Yeah.
In which Socrates practices a whole different way of doing philosophy, doing politics, sorry.
Yeah.
Different from what Athenians used to think about what it means to practice politics. But there's a certain, you know, I want to read this more as a monologue. And
okay.
I already told you this.
Yeah.
I think that the first fictitious, in a way, accusation points to, in a way, that Socrates is re-examining his life, re-examining what he has achieved through all his encounters with individuals. And I think that at the end, the question is not only about Athens, but it's also a question about him and maybe, and about his life and about grasping a certain unity of what he had done.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think, well, we can talk about monologue versus dialogue, but I do think, don't you think, for example, when we were reading the Protagoras in State College, in my class on Gorgias and the Protagoras, I think we saw the way in which the way in which Socrates always understands his own life as wrapped up with the conversation that he's having. So I don't know that even if I read this as a dialogue, I could accommodate your point that Socrates' own life is at stake and he's justifying his life, giving an account of his life. But I think he does that in every dialogue in some way, that he sees it as a these dialogues as a moment for him to reaffirm what he does.
But you don't see in any dialogue an explicit explanation of why is he doing philosophy. And I think that this genealogical nature of the apology, in which he explains why he does what he does and why he interprets the oracle in a certain way, points out to, in a way, to a retrospective kind of thinking of what had led to the situation that he is right now, and so I think that I'm fascinated about this dialogue in that way, in this genealogical sense, and it captures very well that philosophy always has to justify itself to a community, and we do that today also. I mean, that's not new. Besides what you are doing, even if you are, you know, a philosophy of language that is working on language and all that stuff, not related to politics, he always implicitly has to justify why he's, in a way, relevant, or why what he does is relevant to the society in a way. And that's like the mark that philosophy, or the cross that philosophy has to carry throughout the history, I think.
I just want to say something about what Nicholas just said about, like, in a dialogue, like the common dialogue Socrates has with another person, he tries to understand the way he speaks so he can transform that. And you think, like, that doesn't happen in this dialogue. But I think, like, what you did in your essay is precisely point that spots or spaces where Socrates, like, anticipating and, like, in a certain way, telling them how to react or not to react or wait is a way to understand the way they speak and also to transform the way they speak.
Yeah.
So it will make this a dialogue in that way.
Maybe
not at the same level, but he's
Also
trying to understand the way the assembly speaks so he can transform that.
I do think he's concerned with the character of the men of Athens, and then at the end we see that he calls only some of them dikastai, which is the sense that they are really true judges. So I think he's concerned with that. There was an issue that came up today that Catalina brought up about how we should really differentiate between Socrates as a gadfly who provokes, and maybe, and she was arguing that maybe it's Plato who's more concerned with the cultivating of habits of philosophy, that Socrates is more provocative than concerned about the education of habits. And I thought that was an important suggestion. I wanted to think a little bit more about it, and I do worry about divorcing the two the two moments, the moment of provocation and the moment of education, maybe. Yeah. So, go ahead, Sandy.
Yeah, so, in the struggle of the apologue, in the struggle of this problem, we will send dialogue, we will send the dialogue.
Yeah.
Man hat das Gefühl, oder man, ja, das frage ich dich. Also man hat das Gefühl, dass in der Apologie Sokrates die Kommunikation von Sokrates mit den Leuten, es ist durch das Beispiel.
Aha.
Und nicht durch das Argument oder durch andere normale Mittel, die er benutzt in anderen Dialogen.
Mhm.
Ja, also es ist mehr das Verhalten von Sokrates vor den Gericht, ja.
So Sokrates als Beispiel. Sokrates genau. Selbst als Beispiel.
Als Beispiel. Und so ist, wie er sich kommuniziert mit den anderen. Das ist mein Punkt. Also nicht durch ein Argument, nicht durch einen echten linguistischen Dialog, sondern eigentlich einfach ist es mehr dieses Verhalten von ihm vor dem Gericht.
Mhm.
Das wäre nicht eine Besonderheit von diesem Dialog, also es ist nicht mach anders wie Dialog als die anderen.
Ich weiß nicht, ich würde dich fragen auch, ob Sokrates in anderen Dialogen, ob er auch ein Beispiel ist drin.
Ja, auf jeden Fall ist ein Beispiel, das ist klar, das ist auf jeden Fall ein Beispiel. Aber normalerweise die Art und Weise, wie er schafft, die Leute zu provozieren, ist durch den Elenchos.
Okay. Ja? Mhm.
Ja? Durch diese Prüfung. Durch diese, Und hier gibt es nicht ein richtiges Elenchos. Es gibt einen kleinen Elenchos mit dem Meleto, aber mit den die Kastei nicht.
Genau. Ne? Das stimmt. So, okay, I'm going to recap for a second. So, a really important point that Sergei is making is that and this goes to your question, your point too, I think, Nicholas, in the apology, Socrates seeks to persuade, in a sense, is through being an example of living a philosophical life, and that also is why he justifies he gives this elaborate account of why he has always been the way he is. And I think there is something important about saying this is a different dialogue because he's more forthcoming about that. Although in the Gorgias, he does say why he does the things he does with Gorgias a little bit more than with others. But he doesn't justify his philosophical activity in the way that he does in the apology. But then Sergio's point is, well, in the other dialogues, Socrates is using language to refute, to use elenchos, to refute people. We could talk a little bit more about the diversity of strategies Socrates uses in his refutation, so that there's not a single mode by which he refutes people. Now to defend a point a little bit that I was trying to make is I do think that we can't divorce the, and I don't know that you were suggesting this, Sergio, but we can't divorce the example of Socrates from the things Socrates says and the ways in which his arguments work in the dialogue. So I think maybe the example strategy in the apology is in the foreground, is given priority, but both are operating all the time together. Was denkst du darüber?
Ich weiß nicht, ob ich richtig die Frage verstanden habe.
Die Frage ist, als ob wir zwei verschiedene Sachen haben, nämlich Sokrates als Beispiel und Sokrates als jemand, der Elenchos benutzt. Ich würde sagen, dass die beiden zusammen immer zusammen sind. Und aber im in anderen Dialogen ist die Elenkos erst vielleicht oder primar und die diese Beispiele Sache sind ein bisschen in der Hintergrund.
Ja, das ist ja, das ist eine sehr gute Frage. Also es ist klar, also mein Punkt zuerst war, wenn er mit den anderen Umgang hat, ja, es ist klar, dass sie, dass er die anderen provoziert, ja, durch den Elenkos. Ja,
so Socrates provokes the one with whom he's talking through the reputation, through Elenkos.
Right? Through Elenkos, ja.
Aber hier in Apologenes.
Ja, ich habe das Gefühl, dass nein. Also es gibt nicht diese richtige Elenkos, zum Beispiel wie in Gorgias. Ja? Yeah. Also in Gorgias, der Punkt ist, ich mache, dass Gorgias sich zu einem Widerspruch geht.
Yeah, so you, we bring Gorgias to a contradiction, and then Gorgias realizes, oh yeah, if I have to teach justice, I'll teach justice, right? So that's a good example of a traditional Elenkos, where you take an take an opposite position, and then show there's a contradiction so that you can.
Yes.
So that's a pretty traditional.
Okay. Mit diesem Instrument, also Aporia. Mm-hmm. Also ich bringe in Aporia die Leute.
Yeah, genau.
Ja, und das sehe ich nicht in der Apologie. Also bring er zu Aporia.
So,
die Kastei.
Das ist eine Frage für Nicholas, glaube ich. Das ist eine Frage. So the question is, Socrates bring the men of Athens, the dikastai, the jurors, into aporia in the apology. What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, the only way that we could see an aporia in the dialogue is where it explicitly is. He's reminding him when the time the Chaerephon, you know, went to the oracle, and the oracle said that no one is wiser than you.
Mm-hmm.
And then Socrates enters into this perplexity or aporia state of mind, because he says, God cannot lie. So in a way, that statement is true. But at the same time, I don't feel myself as the wisest, or at least one of the wiser men in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a contradiction, at least, you know, when you see the both propositions in that way. And then Socrates, that aporia causes, in a way, what the catfight does. It makes Socrates to go in an activity of, you know, entering into dialogue with others and doing philosophy, because he's in a way skeptical about the truthfulness of the oracle saying.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of impiety there.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the judges enter into this kind of, because aporia is always elaborating in the sense that you have a belief P, for example, and you have a belief Q, and Q and P are inconsistent. So you have to discard one. You cannot say the God doesn't lie, and at the same time believe that you're not the wiser in Athens.
Okay, so let me make a proposal
and
see if you think I'm completely crazy. What if the aporia is between the values of the Athenian culture embodied by the assembly, the men, the jurors there, and the values and figure of Socrates? That in fact the entire apology is staged as a conflict between these two sets of values. One which, as Socrates would say, values wealth and power and a certain kind of speaking that is persuasive, and one that values truth and justice and a way of speaking that is oriented toward the best. And that, in fact, the dialogue itself displays the inability of the Athenian men of Athens to accommodate in any way the figure of Socrates and the life of Socrates, because it is contradict. It is in so clear contradiction to what they do. So that's really where the aporia in the dialogue is, and that is, and it's resolved in the only way an aporia can be in that sense, by getting rid of one of the opposing position, namely Socrates.
But who will suffer the aporia, like the reader of the text?
Well, I think both the reader and I think the men of Athens do suffer, because that's when they speak out. That's when they're feeling the power of, when they're feeling challenged, when they're feeling the power of that contradiction between what Socrates is saying you should, the way you should live, and the way you do live. When they feel that, they speak out. And that's why we have these disruptions, these indignant responses. And their ultimate response is no. I can't. We can't do that. We're not going to do that. This is so different from our lives. So I don't know. Is that possible to read the dialogue as aporetic in that sense?
Yeah, probably. I think.
Yes.
I think you can say this. Yes. Mm. And yeah, it's a very innovative way to rethink aporia in more general terms, because aporia is usually connected with the individual and the state of mind of the individual, and not with habits or hexes that mm-hmm. are cultivated in mm-hmm. a community.
So what would happen then for your, I know you're interested in thinking about aporia, particularly also as it relates to law and the law, and if we thought about it as being directed, as I'm trying to argue in the apology, to not to an individual, but to a city.
Right.
To a community.
Yeah.
Kind of something like, the way you put it is like two sets of values mm-hmm. confronting the self. Something that really caught my attention when I was reading the text was that you say like the refusal of the city to integrate Aristotle is an incapacity.
Yeah.
But when you say like, but when you refer to the refusal of Socratic politics to give up anything, you don't characterize it like an incapacity too. You say it's just a refusal. And I think like,
it's
true if you're doing there, because you say like, yes, they're incapable of taking that. They're just like, I don't know if you got my question, but
so maybe
it's just a refusal. It's not an incapability.
So wait a minute. Okay. Good. That's a good point. But so let me argue this and say, Socrates shows himself to be capable of practicing, could do traditional Athenian politics. He does show himself in the dialogues to be pretty persuasive, if he wants to be, to even use rhetoric in the traditional way of rhetoric, to flower up language and make it all beautiful. Now, when he does that, he often does it in the voice of, I'm going to take on the voice of, let's say, Diotima in the symposium, or he takes on the voice of someone else to do it, to show he can do it. In the Phaedrus, all the speeches that he gives in the Phaedrus are examples of how he has the capacity to do that. He could have been probably one of the greatest rhetoricians in all of Athens if he wanted to, of course it's Plato putting the words into his mouth, so Plato could have been, maybe that's a better way of putting it. So he does. It's not an incapacity for Socrates to practice traditional Athenian politics. He could do that. But I still want to insist that it is an incapacity for the Athenians to take into themselves the habits of the philosophical life. And I think that is a standing question for us now and today: is can we ourselves take on those excellences of a philosophical life? And what would that mean? What is it, what do those things involve? Socrates, I think, helps us see that, a certain way of speaking, a certain orientation toward the truth, a certain commitment to engaging people in ways that move everyone toward the good and the just, or at least to consider the good and the just. But the issue that we are faced with in a dialogue like this is, can those habits be cultivated in a community, not just in an individual? He has trouble enough doing it in an individual. But can we do it in a community?
But the fact that almost half of the jury at the end vote that he's not guilty doesn't mean that the men of Athens are also capable of doing that.
Yeah, I think
not so. Not completely, but yeah. There's still.
And I think that's all we ever have. I mean, that's why it's so significant from my perspective that Socrates does call some of them dikastai, juror, true judges, because and as he says at the beginning of the text, a true judge is one who can discern justice in the thing said, and a good speaker is someone who speaks the truth. That's different from what other conceptions of a good judge or a good speaker is. Traditional Athenian politics says by virtue of being a citizen, given the power to judge. And I think Socrates wants to question that. He wants to say, no, the people who can hear the truth here, discern the just, they're the true judges. So I think Socrates is victorious. I mean, is not victorious, but because I don't want to put it in agonistic winner-loser terms, but is successful with many. I mean, with more than he was actually surprised by how successful he was in the end. But maybe that's also part of the lesson of the dialogue, which is that we won't have this won't be completely successful, and you're only ever going to have some portion of people convinced that they should really lead their lives in this way, committed to truth and to putting words in the service of truth. Yeah.
Christopher, ich habe eine Frage. Es ist alles verbunden, aber es ist nicht das Thema. Aber es gibt etwas, das mir, ich fand das schön in deinem Aufsatz. Ja. Es ist, wenn du sagst, was ist das? Das ist in Seite 7.
Uh-huh.
Ja. Du sagst etwas total Schönes. Ich muss das einfach mal sicher mal auf Englisch kann ich nicht. Also, du sagst, dass die erste politische Veränderung, ja, das ist Transformation.
So, this passage where for genuine political transformation, so let me read that real quick. For genuine political transformation first becomes possible there, where the capacity to imagine life differently is awakened.
Genau. Yeah. Das ist die Worte, die ich total interessant finde. Mm-hmm. Also, normalerweise kann man sagen, okay, Socrates hat einen politischen Ziel, und das Ziel ist Anerkennung von Ignoranz, oder Anerkennung von Widersprüchen,
uh-huh.
oder Anerkennung, oder man erfährt eine neue Philosophie oder sowas. Und du sprichst über die Fähigkeit, sich vorstellen, ein anderes Leben.
Mm-hmm.
Also das ist viel breiter und viel interessanter. Also es ist sehr, sehr emotiv.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also wie verstehst du das? Also,
so, okay, good. Well, first of all, thank you. For those of you who didn't understand German, those were a lot of praising words for my a passage in my paper. So, all right, excellent. I appreciate that.
Heute wollte ich das sagen, aber es gab keine Zeit dafür.
Ja,
ne? Dann wollte ich mal fragen, weil das war sehr interessant. Das fand ich total interessant. Also es ist nicht eine Anerkennung von etwas, normalerweise das ist das Ziel von der sokratischen Lenkung, ne? Sondern die Fähigkeit, sich etwas ein anderes Leben zu verstehen.
Genau.
Ne?
So, and the point that Sergei is making now is that, so we're not, when I talk about the capacity to imagine life differently, normally when we talk about Plato and Socrates, you talk about the recognition of contradiction or recognition of aporia, but what I'm trying to articulate, and I've tried to articulate it in a different context too, is what I call ethical imagination. So ethical imagination is the ability to imagine one's way into the position of the other and to see it from see things from their perspective, even if you don't. One can never do that completely, obviously, but to cultivate the ability to imagine what it's like for them. And I do think that's important. I do think Socrates has that capability. I think in some ways the power of his elenkos is rooted in his ability to imagine the commitments of the people he's talking with. To imagine that, for example, in the Phaedo, that Simmias and Cebes are committed to a certain kind of understanding of Pythagorean understanding of the soul, for example, or that the people that he's talking to, well, Callicles, let's say, is committed to certain. A good example is with Paulus, where in the Gorgias, where Socrates says things that are just, I think, meant to be provocative to Paulus, which is, oh, if you really want to hurt your enemy, you should work to let them escape from punishment. Which, to somebody like Paulus, with his commitments, strikes him as completely crazy. And I think Socrates mm-hmm. doesn't mean it literally necessarily. He means to provoke Paulus because he imagines. He's a good imaginer. He can imagine into Paulus's position and therefore try to move Paulus. Now he doesn't succeed so well with Paulus, but I think that's important. That the capacity to imagine our ways into the lives of others is the ground for political transformation, for personal transformation, I think, too. Yeah.
No. I mean, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, like, the whole thing was about, like, a politic of other.
Uh-huh.
Because the idiosyncratic is, like, try to integrate the individual into the public.
Yeah.
But the individual is, in a certain way, the trace of the other. You know, like, it's not public, it's me.
Right.
And it's not absorbed at that public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, trying to integrate the individual on my private life into the public life in a certain way is trying to introduce the otherness into this center
mm-hmm.
way of living or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe like doing justice to the other is precisely, I mean, the justice that Socrates maybe is aiming to is like recognizing the otherness
mm-hmm.
and trying to bring that to the public sphere.
Right.
And maybe that's why he says like, the only thing, I mean, that lack of knowledge
mm-hmm.
that Socrates also praises a lot
yeah.
is precisely maybe that, like, I don't know you,
right.
but that's the principle of the ethics, like, recognizing mm-hmm. that I don't know the other, and in the dialogue, recognizing that, and trying to make that the basis
mm-hmm.
of a public politic,
yeah.
like, recognizing the other. And when you were saying, like, at the end, he recognizes some of the men of Athens, like true,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, the castor.
The castor, yeah, the castor.
It's precisely mm-hmm. because they were
true jurors.
They were able to recognize the otherness of Socrates and say, like,
yeah.
hey, we want to integrate you into the public life. We won't reduce you, we won't kill you, but we will accept your otherness
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
into the politic
mm-hmm.
of.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a deeper challenge at the end, especially, and I try to play this out a little bit with the vocabulary, or with the image of Socrates at the being fed at the Prytaneum, which would have integrated Socrates into the very center of the life of the city. And I think the notion that Socrates would no longer be seen as an other to the city, that in fact the city would begin to take up the habits of Socratic life, is obviously Athens is far from that at this point when they put him to death, but I think that's the challenge that Socrates is presenting to them, is, you know, to what degree could this community take on these habits of thinking and acting and speaking in a way that would move the city itself toward the just. So actually, what I was trying to say in the early part of the paper about Socratic idiosyncrasy and playing with this word for idiosyncratic, which means takes the Greek idiotes, which means what is one's own most, or also what is sort of negative connotations of an idiot, as somebody who's just concerned with one's private, his or her own private world. But the positive side of that is that to be the, what is one's own most, one's the individual own most concerns, and then syncrates, meaning you know, to bring together in a way that is communal. So it's, I was trying to emphasize that Socratic idiosyncrasy is exactly this attempt to integrate the individual into the community in a way that doesn't do away with the individual, the singularity or the otherness of the one.
And in page, I'm continuing with this, on page 22, you say, like, what Socrates is aiming at is he wants to cultivate in them an ability to live in a state of continued provocation. And I was reading that, like, yes, if Socrates is, like, absorbed or integrated into the public, the people still need to be provocative.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that provocation is like the performance
Correct.
Of the otherness. You
right.
know, like,
so
I mean, you can integrate them, but there are going to be still some others outside that still need to provocate the. And
well, I think the provocative life that we need to habituate ourselves to is a philosophical life, in the sense that there is always something to be thought, something to be questioned, and the good itself, the true itself, the just itself, is always elusive, so that you can never allow a certain kind of final good, final truth, final justice to settle in on a city. To the degree to which it does that, it has missed what the truth and what justice is. And so that's right, that you have to cultivate in, we have to cultivate in ourselves and in our communities an ability to be, to constantly questioning our prejudices and our assumptions and what we thought was just or what we thought was so, you know, a mode of constant reflection and willingness to fallibilism in a pragmatic sense, a willingness to recognize what our own limitations in that sense. Yeah. So, well, I want to thank you all for joining me on the Digital Dialogue. This has been wonderful, and especially for inviting me down to Bogota here in Colombia. It is wonderful to be here, and it's a great privilege to be with all of you. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.